This workshop is sponsored by the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which acts in collaboration with the Centre for Social Legal Studies. The Centre for Social Legal Studies, I'm sure, is well known to everyone here as a research institute of long standing within the University of Oxford. The object of the Centre for Social Legal Studies is to conduct research into law and society. Less known to many of you will be the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which was founded just less than 2 years ago. The idea being, along the lines of a think tank, to try to bridge the gap and to try to bridge academic research, academic writing, and more practical professional problems of the role of law in society. National society, European society, American society, international society, very ambitious. But anyhow, the foundation and the centre work closely together on these in organising these occasions, the object being to try to bring to bear on real practical issues both the learning from the academic side and the practical wisdom and experience from those who are engaged in it. So it's with great pleasure, therefore, that I'm able to welcome our lecturer, Professor Martin Shapiro. Now, I hardly need really introduce Professor Shapiro. I think it's generally agreed amongst my colleagues, that Professor Shapiro is the elder statesman, emphasis on the statesman there rather than the elder statesman of the study of courts. Anyone who's dipped into this subject, even in the most shallow waters, will have come across Professor Shapiro's writings from going back 25, 30 years on American courts, on European courts, on comparative analyses, on administrative, with a particular emphasis, I think, on the administrative aspects of American judiciary. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Shapiro. He has also held many different positions over the years, but at the moment is professor at Berkeley and straddles both the politics department and the law faculty, or the law school, as they call it there. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Shapiro. Now, before I hand over to Professor Shapiro, I'd also like to welcome and introduce Sir Stephen Sedley, again, to anyone in this business, a fairly well-known name. Sir Stephen Sedley has been a member of the Court of Appeal now for some years. He is what we might call a high-profile member of that court. His decisions in the area of public law, civil liberties, the Human Rights Act, I think, have been one of the most inspiring amongst the judicial approaches to these issues. And so it's a great pleasure again to have Sir Stephen Sedley to comment on the lecture. Now, if we have time, we'll have some questions after the lecture and the discussion, but we do want to finish by 6:30, so there will be plenty of time over the next 2 days for questions and discussion if we run over a little bit today. So on that note, I'd like to invite Professor Shapiro to present his lecture. Thank you very much.
It's my tendency to wander around, and I'm not supposed to do that today. I need to stay by the microphones. So if I begin to wander, you wave at me or something and tell me that I'm on. I'd like to thank the Foundation and the Center for the invitation to be here. It gives me an opportunity to see many people who's otherwise I've known only by the names on their work, and to speak to some old friends coming from as far apart as Boston and Bologna, and particularly to renew my acquaintance with Sir Stephen Sedley. We've otherwise met only in Greece, oddly enough. Calendars and schedules change over the years, but when I first began teaching in the university, the first week of university lectures always corresponded to the World Series. And so during that first week of lectures, one heard sighs and groans and moans and laughs of exultation. And if I hear any of those today during this meeting, I'll know that they have not been generated by me, but by outside sources. I've written a fairly long paper, which no doubt will be available to people, and I'm going to speak only briefly and sometimes telegraphically about parts of it. First of all, I have in the paper not bothered to try to argue at length that courts make law. I take it that the proposition that courts make law is so widely accepted. Indeed, I found lately reading old stuff that it was widely accepted in the 19th century as well, that I simply assert it and don't bother trying to argue it in any way. An assertion that I'm more interested in and particularly interested in your response to is the following, that judges, when they make law, follow essentially the same thought processes, engage in the same ways of making decisions that legislators and administrators do, that there's really only one way of thinking about making law, and everybody who makes it thinks in the same way. So that if you wish to defend judicial lawmaking, it oughtn't to be on the ground that judges bring something unique to the thought process of how law is made. And let me examine that point or assertion in three contexts. One is constitutional rights review by courts. The second is judicial review of administrative action. And the third is the implementation of statutes or common law rules by courts. The argument in constitutional judicial review runs as follows, that when courts do constitutional judicial review in the rights area, all of them everywhere in the world always use the same basic test, which in the United States is called a balancing test and more often in Europe is called a proportionality test. That is, constitutional questions are nearly, rights questions are nearly always questions in which two different rights or interests come into conflict with one another, and the legislature has chosen to give priority to one of those rights or interests over the other. Privacy, for instance, over freedom of speech, or national security over due process of law. That, in short, constitutional rights decisions by judges are always balancing of interest decisions. Which interest should we prioritize over which other interest in a particular situation? And, of course, that's precisely what legislatures are supposed to do, is deal with interests, balance them, and prioritize them. Furthermore, any court that uses a balancing test or a proportionality test will also use what's known in the United States as a least means test. Since we begin with the proposition that both of the interests are interests of value, even if we give priority to one of those interests over the other, it follows just as a matter of logic and common sense that the interest that is to be deprioritized, that is to be sacrificed to the more important interest, should be sacrificed as little as possible. That is, whatever interest is legitimately on the plate of government to attain, it ought to attain that interest with as little damage to other valuable interests as possible. And so if the government, for instance, passes a privacy statute prioritizing individual privacy rights over freedom of speech, it ought to pass the privacy statute that does the least possible damage to freedom of speech compatible with the protection of the interest in privacy. Now, if a judge uses a balancing least means approach to constitutional rights questions, all he can do is, is first decide whether he will agree with the legislature on which right is to be prioritized, and the legislature has, of course, had to go through the process of thinking about which right to prioritize, and then if he agrees with the legislature as to which right is to be prioritized, what the judge must then do under the least means or proportionality formula is imagine every possible statute the legislature might have enacted to achieve the interest it is seeking to achieve. Evaluate which of those statutes would achieve the legislature's interest at the least cost to the interest or right being sacrificed. And then if the legislature has not chosen that one, the legislature has acted unconstitutionally. That is, all a judge can do in constitutional rights cases is to do a thought experiment as if he were the legislator. And he's thinking in exactly the same way that legislatures would have to think. Now, this doesn't mean that the judge will necessarily substitute entirely his own judgment for that of the legislature. He may go through this process and at the end conclude, well, I personally would have chosen a different statute than the legislature did, but I can see that the legislature chose one that reasonable men might have accepted. But in order to arrive at a position in which he can determine whether the legislature has chosen one that reasonable men and women might have accepted, he has to go through the same process the legislature did. Consider all the potential statutes and determine which one will gives you the best cost-benefit ratios in terms of whatever interest you're seeking to protect. If we move then to judicial review of administrative action, let me concentrate on that kind of review in which a court is reviewing what the British call delegated legislation, that is, rules made by administrators to carry out statutory language enacted by the legislature, and where the judge's business is to determine whether the delegated legislation is lawful or unlawful, does or does not accord with the parent statute. It doesn't seem to me that there is any kind of thinking that the judge can do which is any different than the administrator did in making his decision as to which rule the administrator would adopt to implement the statute. Both the judge and the administrator are acting as supplementary lawmakers, as agents of the legislature. Both have to make the best stab they can at what the legislature intended. Both have to sometimes confess to themselves that the legislature didn't know what it intended, or intended six different things and refused to specify which it intended most. And then what any judge is going to have to do is the same thing the legislature had, the administrator had to do. Consider the language of the statute, his best guess as to the intention of the legislature, his best assessment of what the world out there is like, what policies are more or less likely to succeed, and then on the basis of a kind of standard cost-benefit analysis, decide whether the administrator has chosen an interpretation of the statute which gives you a good, decent cost-benefit result in terms of the aim of the statute. Finally, let me just deal with courts which, in the course of litigation, have to interpret statutory language themselves or to apply common law rules. Long ago, and at great length, I argued somewhere else that courts, both English-speaking and continental courts, basically follow a process or practice of stare decisis in the interpretation of statutes and in the application of common law rules. The French judges don't really do it any differently than English judges do, that they both use the same system of stare decisis in the interpretation of statutes, that is, in making up what the statute means when the statute doesn't tell you what it means. And that the practice of stare decisis, if you write out the rules for the practice of stare decisis, those rules correspond exactly to the rules for incremental decision-making that all policymakers use all over the world on all questions. My assertion here is that whenever you make law, you are, unless you are an absolute fool, you make it incrementally. That is, if it's not broken, you don't try to fix it. If something is broken and you want to fix it, you try fixes that are as close to where you were as you can possibly get. You don't try big changes. That in trying to make new law, you do not try to exactly prioritize all values or exactly learn all facts. That instead you make the best policy guess you can as to some new policy that's very close to old policies. Then you hold your breath and pray. And when you get the results of whatever legal rule you have enacted, that gives you feedback to go on to enact the next legal rule, which you hope will be a slightly better approximation of good policy than the previous one was. And I argue that judges do that, and legislatures do that, and administrators do that, that indeed everybody who makes public policy does those things, at least everybody who's at least moderately successful does those things. Therefore, I'm arguing that judges use the same incremental cost-benefit analysis, balancing least means analysis that administrators and legislators do, and that therefore judges have nothing of a special or peculiar or better nature in terms of policy-making techniques to offer us than administrators and judges, and administrators and legislators would have. Well, that then leads fairly obviously to the question of that it always haunts all discussions on the topics that we're about to address for the next few days, which is the role of judicial lawmaking in democratic systems. Because aside from the American states, most judges in the world are not in democracies are not elected but appointed officials. I'm going to assert now, again subject to all the discussion you want to have later, that for all of the oceans of ink spilled trying to make judicial lawmaking compatible with democracy, it cannot be made compatible with democracy. Judicial lawmaking is simply undemocratic or anti-democratic in character. And again, some of you may wish to offer the various arguments for the for compatibility that can be made. But with Jeremy Waldron and a number of other people, I would argue that none of those arguments, no matter what your theory of democracy is, none of them will allow you to find judicial lawmaking compatible with democratic government, because ultimately judicial lawmaking is law made by unelected officials, and then in democracies the laws ought to be made by elected ones. That leads then really to the final point that I wish to offer for discussion, and one on which I'm not entirely sure. One response, and indeed my response to the proposition I've just offered, that judicial lawmaking is essentially anti-democratic and cannot be rendered compatible with democracy, my response to that is, yes, that's true, but is uninteresting. The demos can choose to have judicial lawmaking if it wants to have that. Or rather, the demos may decide that courts are convenient to have for various purposes. They may decide that constitutional judicial review in defense of rights is good for them. The demos may want that. The demos may decide that judicial review of administrative action is good for them. Indeed, legislatures in most countries in the world specify when they want judicial review and when they don't of administrative action. And so there the demos is specifying that it wants at least administrative judicial review. And the demos in most countries decides that it wants courts to deal with conflict processing problems with civil disputes and criminal law. And my argument here simply is that if the demos finds it convenient to have a functioning judiciary to do various tasks for it, it just has to accept judicial lawmaking, as undemocratic as it is, as one of the costs of having judges. Or as I put it in another place, if you buy a junkyard dog to bite other people, you must sometimes expect to be bitten yourself. If the demos decides it wants constitutional judicial review to protect individual rights, then it has to accept that courts will sometimes thwart the will of majorities in protecting those rights. If it wants courts to process day-to-day disputes, the demos has to accept that the judges will make a good deal of law in the process of settling those disputes. That is, my argument is that courts as a basic institutional characteristic of courts is that they do and must make law in the process of doing what they do. So if you choose to have them and you ask them to do things, you have chosen to have judicial lawmaking, and the demos is entitled to do that if it wants to. It's also entitled to place any limitations it wishes to on that lawmaking process. For instance, it can create a constitution with an easy amending process so as to limit the power of constitutional courts to engage in constitutional lawmaking. Well, if you don't buy that argument as a justification for judicial lawmaking, even in a democracy, there is one other argument, which is to turn my basic argument on its head and to say precisely what's good about having judicial lawmaking in democracies is that judges are not elected. That is, one has to erect this non-election into a virtue in order to defend judicial lawmaking in democratic states. And the argument is one you're all familiar with. It runs in the following way, that we know by introspection, as well as by the work of the great philosophers, that each of us is a bundle of short-term, highly particular, highly selfish preferences, of self-interested desires. And at the same time, each of us has longer-term, more general preferences that are more oriented to the general good, that each of us contains both the urge to selfishly satisfy ourselves now and the urge to live in a good society with good rules. That elected politicians are anchored to short-term electoral cycles and are therefore likely to give high priority to short-term, immediate, self-interested values. While judges, precisely because they are not anchored to short electoral cycles, are more likely to give prominence to long-term and general values. It is the legislature that is most likely to want to limit the freedom of speech of the people it hates at the moment. It is the judges who are most likely to say, I may hate them at the moment, but the long-term value of freedom of speech requires to defend those for me to defend those that I hate at the moment. Now, this argument that judges contribute to democracy because they better represent our long-term general interests than legislatures do, which are excellent at representing our short-term selfish interests, that argument depends upon having faith that judges do, in fact, themselves in their own minds, give greater preference to long-term general interests than to either their own or other people's short-term immediate preferences. In a sense, I think that's what the yearning behind the expression judicial independence is, partly that yearning that the judge will think about what's good for all of us in the long run while the politicians are thinking of short-term immediate gains and losses, and therefore we want to protect the judges from the politicians. The question is whether we have faith, that faith in judges, whether judges are really that sort of person, whether they really do liberate themselves from selfish short-term interests and pursue long-term general ones. I myself am highly dubious. I do not hold to this particular religion. Some of you may, and we have some judges present who can give testimony, if they like, on their own levels of virtue in this connection. One further point which clouds somewhat this argument that judges ought to engage in lawmaking because that means that long-term social interests will be adequately represented as well as short-term ones, is a concern about judicial responsibility. It can be argued that judges are less responsible than other government officials and therefore are not to be trusted. In the United States, for instance, at least 20 American state Supreme Courts have, using their own state constitutions, required the equalization of per capita school expenditure in the United States, an issue that is now before the English in various ways. The courts ordered the equalization of school expenditure as a constitutional matter and did so under their state constitution, so their decisions cannot be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. They can't be appealed to anybody. They could be wiped out by amending the state constitutions, but that has not happened. But the state courts who order the equalized school expenditure do not have to pass the tax laws or the school budgets. It's the legislatures that have to do that. The courts have intervened in this extremely complicated matter, said what they had to say, and then said, and you guys fix it. And the result in the states in which the courts have said that is it's never been fixed. Each of those states goes through an almost annual crisis over school budgets, because they are under court orders to equalize, and the legislatures simply cannot find the political means to either raise taxes enough to equalize or to cut school expenditures in the richer districts and level down per capita the school expenditure. Now, I myself do not want to push the argument of judicial irresponsibility very far, because there are obviously some areas in which judges are held highly responsible. I think, by and large, for instance, in criminal law, judges do tend to get blamed, indeed excessively blamed, for crime. And I think most judges who handle criminal cases are aware that the public holds them responsible for crime. American courts sometimes order various reforms of prisons and threaten to order the release of all the prisoners unless the reforms are carried out. But the reforms are rarely carried out, and no court, to my knowledge, has ever ordered the release of all the prisoners. One can make the same kind of point about security matters. Security matters, either in terms of war or the current concerns with terrorism, raise serious constitutional rights issues and serious issues even of administrative due process. But on the whole, it seems to me that if you look around the world, courts have been very loath to interfere very much in the security matters of government. That they have been very sensitive to the argument that it is someone else who is responsible for all of those lives, and judges ought not to casually interfere with the activities of those who are charged with that responsibility. It's particularly noticeable in cases like in the United States or in Israel, for instance, that courts are often very big on proclaiming civil liberties, but are very, very cautious about actually limiting government action in any way in those areas, usually precisely because they are subject to the argument that it's all very well for you judges to talk about these things, but if the buildings get blown up and the children get torn limb from limb, it's not you judges who are going to have to bear the responsibility for that. It's someone else. And judges tend to retreat in that matter. So that while the argument for judicial lawmaking in terms of the protection of long-term values may be somewhat undercut by this problem of responsibility, I don't think it's undercut terribly much. If I want to undercut that argument, I suppose I would move mostly to the American quantitative literature on judicial decision-making, which tends to show that judges are very, very heavily influenced by partisan political considerations of precisely the same kind that influence the legislative bodies and politically appointed executives, so that they are not defending long-term, less electorally connected values, but are motivated largely by the same short-term values as are elected politicians. But the data is very heavily American. For most courts in the world, such data cannot even be gathered, and the American data is always subject to serious validation questions. Well, what I've attempted to do is make a couple of very strong assertions, namely that courts do not go about lawmaking by thinking about it in any different way that other people do, the assertion that judicial lawmaking is essentially anti-democratic, and beyond that, I have opened the question, I hope, of whether we can reasonably expect judges to defend a long-term socially oriented values more than we can expect electorally connected officials to do so. Thank you.
I didn't expect to be on my feet quite so soon. But I'm very pleased to be on my feet. Perhaps I can say that as a toiler in the judicial vineyard, I've found that judges are actually very bad, and lawyers generally very bad at getting a decent conspectus on what it is that they do. And one of the reasons I'm here is that I'm one of the many admirers of Martin Shapiro's work, because I've heard him in the past, and have seen how much better a view, a conspectus, political scientist, a good political scientist can have on law than lawyers themselves have. So I take everything he says with seriousness. Having said that, let me attempt to perhaps a slightly parodic version of what it is that Martin has floated today, because that's what I want to comment on. It's an argument which is put by him, as always, with balance and and charm. It isn't always put quite so charmingly or in quite such balanced a fashion. Judges are politically irresponsible, it goes. They do not have to count the cost of what they decide. They do not have to pay a price for what they do. Their public law adjudications are thinly disguised, or perhaps sometimes well disguised, political interventions, and are as subjective as all political interventions are. But that's what happens, says the argument, if you install judges, give them independence, and ask them to administer your constitution. You are keeping a junkyard dog, as Martin says. And if you get bitten from time to time, well, that's what happens when you keep a junkyard dog. I have to say that I've gone to and fro in my response to this striking metaphor for what I do in my daily work. On the whole, I think I like it. It is an image of a beast which has considerable strength, but is fiercely loyal to the apparatus to which it belongs, and is willing to live in extremely harsh conditions, be fed on rubbish, and to take orders, only to the extent that they don't interfere with its natural propensity, which is to bite people. That seems to me not a bad metaphor at all. Thank you, Martin. I'd never thought of it that way myself. The argument goes on that the judges limit or disguise their own interventionism by nowadays purporting only to be assessing the proportionality of measures undertaken by government. But that, for heaven's sake, says the argument, is exactly what government is there to do, to take a proportionate decision. So judges are simply in the business of attempting to govern government. The only thing, finally, the argument says that you can say for them is that they are something of a break on short-termism and majoritarianism, and perhaps also that the alternative, that is not having a judiciary, is almost as bad as having one. Now, I understand the force of all that. In those much cruder terms in which I've posed it, we hear it pretty well every day now in the media. Let me advance one or two suggestions for a contrary theory and a contrary approach. First of all, of course, if you don't like the junkyard dog, well, try keeping the burglars out yourself. Judges are there for a purpose that others don't manage to fulfill. And the whole point, of course, of the majoritarian argument is that majoritarianism does not deliver a number of fundamental individual rights unless there is a legal system which is there to do that. It is not simply that you are making up a democratic deficit. You are doing something without which there is not a democracy. You are creating, if you take out the judicial element, an illiberal society, a majoritarian dictatorship, with nothing to control the impact of that dictatorship upon minorities, and most important of all, perhaps, the minority of one, from which all human rights begin. Judges make law. This is another truth and half-truth and quarter-truth and untruth, depending upon what you mean by making law. The fact-proof statute is a fiction. The delusion under which all legislation is drafted is that it is possible to predict every situation to which it is going to have to be applied and to provide for it. It's the draftsman's delusion. And it falls apart time after time. What we are doing in 99 cases out of 100, both with statutes and with contracts, is trying to fill the gaps because something has arisen that nobody thought of at the time. When we adjudicate on contracts, we claim that we are simply interpreting the contract that two other people have made, what we are in fact doing in most cases is making the contracts that they would have made if they hadn't been too damn busy trying to outsmart each other on other aspects of the deal. And so with statutes, we sometimes, if we're lucky, simply teasing out a clear meaning from an obscure mode of expression. But very frequently, we are simply trying to apply the law to something the draftsman never thought of. The classic one, of course, is the one that all university teachers use on their first-year students, by law which forbids motor vehicles in the park, and somebody wants to put a World War II Jeep without an engine on a plinth. Is it a motor vehicle in the park? Is it banned? And you have great fun, might have great fun teasing that out with students. The trouble is this kind of thing recurs in real life. Tomorrow I have to spend the day dealing with the Animals Act 1971, which was a carefully worked out attempt to replace hideously complex common law rules that have developed over centuries about liability for damage done by domesticated animals with a simple couple of codified provisions, which on paper look terrific. They're simple, you can understand what they mean. And then something happens. It happened not long ago when some horses bolted and broke through a perfectly good, secure field fence, ended up on the road and did damage. And it was inferred that something must have frightened them. And it's a propensity of horses, when frightened, to bolt, break fences and get out onto the road. And the owner said the House of Lords by 3-2 was liable. Tomorrow we have another version of that to grapple with in my court. Watch this space. But anybody who says that we are making law is wasting their breath. We are attempting to apply law that others have made to a situation they don't seem to have thought about. And that is the typical, in inverted commas, lawmaking situation. What we are in fact seeking to do each time is making sense of law, not making law in any literal sense of writing on a blank piece of paper. And even that is perhaps 1% of the judicial function. 99% of it is applying perfectly intelligible and clear and established law, whether statute or common law, whether delegated or primary legislation, to facts. And the difficult bit is ascertaining the facts and working out how the law applies to them. But if a judiciary were not there to do it, who would do it? It's as straightforward as that. So far as delegated legislation is concerned, I don't agree with Martin that the intent is Parliament's and the enactment of delegated legislation is simply a ministerial function by the executive. The contrary, I believe, is true. That is to say that precisely because Parliament doesn't have the time to decide how this or that scheme should be run in detail, it simply sets out a statutory purpose and enacts a rulemaking power, which it hands over to a nominated executive body, local or national. That body has the right to make whatever rules it thinks just and useful to implement the power. Parliament has no intent beyond the general power that it has conferred, but the courts have a very specific function, two very specific functions in relation to this delegated legislation. One is to make sure that it does not break the bounds of the power that Parliament has in fact given to make the rules. And those powers can be derived either from the statute itself or just as often from the general and fundamental rules of common law, for example, that nobody is to be condemned unheard, which we are repeatedly having to interpolate into delegated legislation because the rulemaker has forgotten about them. But I would defend to the death our position, our entitlement, indeed our obligation to do that. The other role, of course, is in relation to delegated legislation, is ensuring that it is applied properly, and that is a due process jurisdiction, which, again, we're there to carry out, and it's, I would have thought, an important one. judicial activism. I suppose there are judges who are not activists. They're either asleep or dead. Any other judge who is doing his or her job is an activist. And those who use the phrase activism as a form of political denunciation, one doesn't mind politicians using it, one wouldn't expect anything more sophisticated, but it's worrying that quite a lot of academics have adopted and used it as well, seem to forget that thesis that Professor Francis Cornford advanced, I think, just under a century ago in Cambridge in his Microcosmographia Academica, the most wonderful satire on university politics. Cornford's axiom was that one should never do anything for the first time. This was because, first of all, it would lead to quite unreasonable expectations that you would do it again in the same situation, and nobody should be forced into that position. Secondly, he said that it was because it was necessary as a counterweight to the fallacy that doing nothing was capable of having effect. As you said, it was so obvious as not to require demonstration or argument that doing nothing could never have any effect, so that you could always be safe by doing nothing, but you would always risk creating a dangerous precedent if you did something, particularly if you did something for the first time. One stands back and looks, for example, at the Terry Schiavo case in the United States. 16 judges in all, in different places and different levels of the judiciary, declined to intervene to prevent the withdrawal of life support from that terribly brain-damaged patient. They were denounced for activism by that powerful judicial intellect, Tom DeLay, who actually went so far as to demand their impeachment. Now, DeLay had a point. He had got the point that doing nothing can be a very active form of intervention indeed. And when I started practicing at the bar in the mid-1960s and getting into what wasn't called judicial review, then public law wasn't taught as a subject. And we knew that if we dug around in the books, that there was something called an order of certiorari that you could get if you were lucky. And that was about it. But one experienced in those days in a divisional court presided over by Lord Parker as Chief Justice, one experienced the do-nothing form of activism. One would go to court with some outrageous piece of executive misconduct, and the court would say, by means of sometimes staggering intellectual dishonesty, there is nothing we can do about it, or there is nothing we are prepared to do about it. Now, that seems to me to be a form of interventionism, the upholding of injustice, the upholding of constitutional wrong, which is as active as it is possible to be. And if there's one thing that I would like to achieve in this these short remarks this evening, it is the abandonment by the academic community of any idea that there is such a thing as judicial activism that is worth talking about. As I say, the only thing that is, the only differentiation is between the judge who is awake and the judge who is asleep. The democratic deficit, I've said, I think, a word about already. I don't regard the judicial role as filling a deficit, some sort of malfunction in the democratic process. I regard it as being an integral part of the democratic process, and I think explained why that is so. The way in which judicial review mostly functions, which I've attempted to describe in summary, is in fact exactly what one would expect from that view. In other words, not the judiciary as a fire brigade or the Fifth Cavalry riding in to solve a crisis in their own inimitably lawless way, making up the law as they go along, but a rather tedious grind of trying to apply law that others have made or that judges have made in the past to a situation which has come before the court. And one of the things that I think judges do within the democratic process, and I think this is as true in the United States as here, because I don't think that everything that Martin's described about judges, particularly having short-term political goals of their own, can be terribly easily transposed to this country. But one thing I think is common to both is the fact that there are hot potatoes that politicians will not grasp and that judges grasp because nobody else will. I see Cathy Satchwell nodding, and I suspect she's going to have some examples of rather vivid examples from South Africa about this. But from this, in this country, one can take termination of life support, something which Parliament will not touch because there are no votes in it. The only thing you can do is lose votes by it. And the judges have had to deal in the Tony Bland case, and I think did so very creditably indeed, with how a humane philosophical approach would answer the question that politicians have not wanted to deal with. The Human Rights Act, Martin is right to say, is a new departure, but it's nothing like as radical a departure as anybody reading the newspapers in this country at the moment would imagine. It has not handed the judges any power at all to interfere with primary legislation. The power to interfere with secondary legislation does not come from the Human Rights Act. It is the most fundamental power of the common law to control the lawfulness of executive action. All that the Human Rights Act has done in relation to secondary legislation is to inject certain new criteria into the assessment of the legality of secondary legislation. It also allows us to decide upon, without doing anything about, the legality of primary the compatibility of primary legislation with the Convention on Human Rights. But if we declare an incompatibility, government doesn't have to accept the judicial declaration. If it does, then it will move by a fast track to amend the legislation accordingly. Now, the principal factor that the Convention has injected is not actually a substantive one, although there are, of course, substantive rights, the right to free speech, the right to family life, the right to marry, and so on. It is a procedural or an intellectual injection of the idea that Martin has picked up, the idea of proportionality. Now, this is a novelty for us. It is not something that the common law would ever deal with. And when the common law courts were asked to introduce it, they refused in the 1980s and said it'll have to wait for Parliament. Well, Parliament fetched it in. They fetched it in by the rather interesting indirect means of repatriating the Convention on Human Rights, and with it the jurisprudence of Strasbourg. Now, the Convention on Human Rights does not use the word proportionality anywhere, but it does in the qualified rights in Articles 8, 9, 10, 11 speak of such interference being permitted with those rights as is necessary in a democratic society. Under its very great president, Rolf Riesdahl, the Court of Human Rights realized that if it started messing in literal terms with the question what is tolerable in a democratic society, it would get itself into very deep political water indeed. And what it did was borrow a concept developed by the late 19th century courts of Prussia, though nobody in this country ever likes to admit that, a concept of proportionality, a weighing of ends against means, and a very sophisticated methodology which the court has developed for describing how you go about that process of weighing ends against means. I have been fighting in the 6 years that the Human Rights Act has been in force, not a lone battle, but not exactly a thoroughly well-supported one, to get courts of primary jurisdiction to take this seriously and to realize that saying, oh, I think that's proportionate, is not the way you do it. It's a structured inquiry for which Strasbourg has given us the tools and which we we benefit very much by following and using, because it means that we can give intelligibly structured decisions, and decisions which are transparent and display how it is that we've got from A to B. So proportionality, I think the methodological contribution that proportionality has made is possibly the most significant that the Human Rights Act has actually afforded us. But of course, you won't read that in the newspapers. The other very important contribution, and surprisingly so, it surprised all of us who were looking at the bill of the Human Rights Act, has been Section 19. Section 19 is the section which requires ministers to certify on the front of a bill that they bring before Parliament that it is compliant with the Convention. So that the absence of the certificate means that there is a political row waiting for the movers of the bill. The result is that ministers pay a great deal of attention and take a great deal of time and trouble ensuring that they can put that certificate on the front of the bill. And even though they apply rather hilariously a 51% test, is there a 51% chance that we'll cop it in Strasbourg if we put it in this form? Nevertheless, it means that bills are drafted with the human rights lawyers in attendance to advise on whether the bill is going to pass muster or not on human rights grounds. And it's had some quite dramatic effects. The legislation which was passed to take away from asylum seekers all access to benefits of every kind had to have added a subsection in order to make it convention compliant, which said, but not so as to violate the convention. And when cases started coming before us of people reduced to utter destitution and illness and poverty and begging in the streets by the withdrawal of benefits, we were in a position to say that violates Article 3 of the Convention, that is, inhuman and degrading treatment, and benefits have got to be restored for people who are reduced to that level. The result has been that the government has changed the scheme, and quite rightly too. So that Section 19, which I think most people thought was window dressing, has turned out to be an important and beneficial section, and a dialogue not between the courts and government at all, but between the legislature and the executive. The executive being responsible for the drafting of bills, the legislature being responsible for the passing of them, the courts only being there to make sense of what it is that Parliament has ultimately enacted. Anyway, you'd have expected me to come and be defensive about my job, and you'd have expected Martin to be a little aggressive about it. Not ever with the savagery of a junkyard dog.